day before he entered the hospital. Lewis died at the age of 80 of pancreatic cancer. In a piece he asked the New York Times to publish on the morning of his funeral, John Lewis wrote, "Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. Voting and participating in the democratic process are key. The vote's the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in a democratic society. You must use it because it is not guaranteed. You can lose it," John Lewis wrote. To see our interviews with John Lewis, visit democracynow.org. That does it for our show. John Robert Lewis, rest in power. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the departure of federal agents calms Portland protests. The Portland Police Bureau has been barred from collecting audio and video of Portland protesters, and in national news, the expiration of the eviction ban and enhanced unemployment benefits threatens millions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 31st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. For the first time since the arrival of federal agents over 3 weeks ago, last night's Black Lives Matter protest in downtown Portland was free of less lethal munitions and clouds of tear gas. In fact, it was also free of police presence of any kind. As a result of a Wednesday deal between Governor Kate Brown and federal officials, agents from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and other federal law enforcement agencies were withdrawn from the city. In return, Brown promised that the federal courthouse would be protected by officers of the Oregon State Police. A crowd of over 1,000 peaceful demonstrators listened to speeches and chanted their support for the BLM movement and police reform. But without the provocative presence of federal agents, there were few attempts to vandalize the federal courthouse or tear down the surrounding fence. The small street fires that were started were quickly put out by protesters, who also halted attempts to rattle the fence. Speeches were concluded before 11 p.m., with many protesters heading home far earlier than during previous nights of federal presence, and the state police, who were tasked with protecting the courthouse, remained inside and out of sight. The withdrawal of federal agents was seen as a stinging defeat for President Donald Trump. The self-described law and order president sent the agents to Portland in an effort to crack down on what he described as violent anarchists. But the arrival of government agents swelled the ranks of the protesters from a few hundred to more than 5,000 per night, many of whom were protesting for the first time. The scenes of nightly tear gas attacks by camouflaged federal agents firing less lethal munitions and swinging batons created national and international condemnation. On Monday, Trump tweeted, quote, "We've done a great job in Portland." But even then, it was clear that his tactics were blowing up in his face. In a tweet yesterday, he again called on the governor to clear out the agitators and anarchists in Portland, or the federal government would do it for her. But in a humiliating reply, Brown said, quote, "I think we've had enough political grandstanding from D.C. The president's plan to dominate the streets has failed." She concluded by saying, quote, "The massive and nonviolent protests led by Black Lives Matter activists have inspired the nation. Let's get to work and make this vision a reality." Yesterday, a Multnomah County judge issued a temporary restraining order that bars the City of Portland, including the Portland Police Bureau, from collecting or retaining audio or video of protesters in public spaces. The ruling by Circuit Court Judge Stephen Bouchon resulted from a lawsuit filed earlier in the day by the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU's position was that the PPB filming and broadcasting of protesters violates Oregon state law. That law states that the police cannot collect or maintain information about anyone's political, religious, or social views, or their association or activities, unless they are suspected of a specific criminal activity. The ACLU pointed out that the police live streams zoomed in on individual faces, making protesters vulnerable to facial recognition and surveillance technology. In a statement, Jan Carson of the ACLU of Oregon said, quote, "Today's decision is an important step towards ensuring all people can exercise their rights to protest and assembly without fear of government surveillance." During a Thursday morning press conference, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler apologized for the use of tear gas on protesters. In addition to being Portland's mayor, Wheeler is also the commissioner of the Portland Police Bureau. And during a Q&A session on crowd control, he said that after seeing what he referred to as PPB mistakes on crowd control and crowd dispersal, he issued a tactical directive to limit the use of CS gas in all but life safety circumstances. That directive was issued on June 6th. The mayor went on to say that he had met with Governor Brown, Commissioner Hardesty, and Portland Police Chief Lovell a few days earlier, and they all agreed that the use of tear gas would be limited to situations where there was a risk of serious injury or death. He said that the gas had only been used twice by the PPB during the month of July. Wheeler then said, quote, "I apologize to those nonviolent demonstrators who were subjected to CS gas or LRAD. It should never have happened. I take personal responsibility for it, and I'm sorry." He went on to point out that the distinction between the PPB's limited use of tear gas recently and what he described as the broad, indiscriminate, and nightly use of CS gas by federal officers. He stated that the excessive use of tear gas by federal agents during their time in Portland had the opposite effect of what was intended. Oregon has about $1.5 million left for small businesses that didn't get help from federal coronavirus relief programs. For more on this, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Oregon is helping small businesses hurt by COVID-19 and left behind by federal relief. Community development financial institutions, including four credit unions in the state, are processing and distributing the funds that the legislature approved this month. About $1.5 million in grants are left to be doled out to businesses with 25 employees or fewer. Stacy Weiss Schoenburn heads Albany-based Central Willamette Credit Union. She says some folks were too busy to apply for the Paycheck Protection Program or Economic Injury Disaster Loans.
They're really focusing on keeping their business going, so they haven't had the time or the capacity to pursue a PPP or an EIDL loan. And so this is an opportunity for them to get some funds through the state to assist them in maintaining their business operation.
Weiss Schoenburn says the grants don't have to be paid back and can be used for anything, including rent, utilities, or paying employees. Consolidated Community, Point West, and Trailhead Credit Unions also are distributing grants. The deadline for applications to be submitted, processed, and approved is August 17th. Weiss Schoenburn says they are focused on serving rural communities and historically disadvantaged groups.
Making sure that those individuals that have typically been marginalized or have found it challenging to get access to funds, such as women-owned, Black-owned, and veteran-owned businesses, have the opportunity to take advantage of these grant funds.
She says credit unions are flexible in how they can accommodate businesses.
If you need to fax it to us, we'll accept that. If you need to drop it off in person, we'll accept that. If you can send it electronically, that is ideal.
Business owners can find out more about applying through Central Willamette Credit Union at centralwcu.org. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Last night, Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced that she ordered Umatilla County to revert to stay-at-home status as a result of a dramatic increase in COVID-19 cases. She also said that neighboring Moreau County would be moved back to reopening Phase 1. This is the first time that Brown has reinstated those restrictions since the state began phased reopening on May 15th. She said that the two counties had infection rates of more than 2 per 100 residents, and the county rates were 5 to 6 times the statewide average. The governor also said that about half of the cases could not be traced. She admitted that the order was bad news for working families and business owners in the region, but said, quote, "If we do not act immediately, we could see the virus spread even more rapidly, infecting and killing more community members." Umatilla, Moreau, Jefferson, and Malheur counties have all been listed as red zones by the federal government's coronavirus task force. Brown also added Multnomah, Marion, and Hood counties to the state's watch list, bringing the statewide total on the list to 10. Counties are placed on the watch list when coronavirus is spreading quickly in the area and public health officials cannot trace that spread to specific sources. According to the governor's office, when a county is placed on the watch list, the Oregon Health Authority increases monitoring and communication and deploys additional resources such as epidemiological support, case investigation, and contact tracing help. Based on the New York Times coronavirus map and case count, Oregon has confirmed an average of 341 new cases per day. That's a 5% increase over the number that we were seeing 2 weeks earlier. It's also a dramatic increase from the low of 37 cases per day that the state was tracking on May 25th, 10 days after the state began to slowly reopen. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority announced that there were 416 new cases confirmed statewide and 5 new deaths, bringing the state's death toll to 316. Nike has announced plans to lay off 500 employees at its world headquarters in Beaverton. The layoffs are scheduled to take place on October 1st. In a written notification that was sent to the state last week, the company said, quote, "This permanent reduction in workforce includes members of Nike's corporate leadership team and some corresponding executive assistants." Under Oregon law, companies with more than 100 employees must notify the state when they plan significant layoffs. Nike's announcement is one of the largest to hit Oregon as a direct result of the coronavirus pandemic. The layoffs will include the closure of 2 childcare centers at the Beaverton site. Last month, the company reported a quarterly net loss of $790 million and a year-over-year sales decline of 38%. The virus has forced Nike to shut down most of its retail locations. As a result, the company has announced what it's calling a, quote, "digital transformation" to emphasize online sales. With a growth of 75% last quarter, online sales were one of the few bright spots for the company. Nike said the cuts will result in termination costs of $200 million to $250 million. Mercy Flight's emergency transportation provider is working with people in Jackson County to keep them out of the hospital. For more on this, we go to Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
First responders are reaching beyond emergencies to support people in Southern Oregon. Mercy Flights is the emergency transportation provider in Jackson County. Meg Wills with the coordinated care organization Jackson Care Connect says her organization collaborates with Mercy Flights so that a team of specially trained paramedics can implement a unique support system for people who frequently come to the hospital.
What Mercy Flight mobile integrated paramedics are able to do is to wrap care around people when they've been identified in those acute settings and really ensure that they get linked to services that will hopefully prevent those members from going back into a hospital.
Will says the team offers up to 30 days of transitional support after someone is discharged, including providing a home assessment and help such as educating people about their medications. Sabrina Ballou is supervisor of Mercy Flight's integrated healthcare program. She says paramedics in this program can assess folks anywhere.
We will meet them wherever they're comfortable. So this could be on a street corner, a coffee shop, in their home.
The team has a number of solutions at their disposal. They can connect people with medication-assisted treatment for substance abuse disorders or deliver food boxes, which has been especially important during the COVID-19 pandemic. Ballou says help can be as simple as getting someone's medication.
So they'll get discharged home, but they don't have transportation back to get their medication, or their medications weren't ready for them, or they're just not strong enough or understand the process. So our team will actually go out and pick up their medications for them and deliver them to their home.
Will says 75 to 80% of the people they reach out to engage with the program. She says one of the most powerful things is how mobile the paramedics are.
They're out in the community and they're really reaching out to people in these moments when there's an opportunity to really reflect and think about what is it that I need right now in order not to come back.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. At 5:30, we'll be hearing Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight we'll see a partly cloudy evening with an overnight low of about 70. Tomorrow we can look forward to another sunny day with temperatures in the mid-80s. On this date in 1975, former Teamster Union President Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. He was connected with organized crime and spent time in prison for mail and wire fraud. Although a convicted criminal himself, today's quote from Jimmy Hoffa may be more relevant than ever. He said, quote, "Corporate tax dodging impacts us across generations and over time. It is corrosive, it is unethical, it is unsustainable." Working Americans who have lost their jobs due to the coronavirus are about to have a series of safety nets pulled out from under them. Last week continued the trend of at least 1 million additional Americans filing for unemployment benefits since the coronavirus struck in February. And yesterday it was announced the U.S. economy had shrunk by 9.5% in the second quarter, an annual rate of nearly 33%. The rate of retraction is far and away the highest ever, dwarfing the downturn of 2008 and even the Great Depression. But today, the extra $600 in weekly benefits that was provided to unemployed Americans as part of the CARES Act expires. And last Monday, the federal moratorium on evictions for those living in federally funded housing also expired. A patchwork of states have implemented their own eviction bans, but many of those are also set to expire, and it's unclear if the states can or will extend them. According to Professor Emily Benfer of Princeton University's Eviction Lab, as many as 28 million Americans could be evicted in the next few months. That's three times as many people as the number that lost their homes during the 2008 housing crisis. The democratically controlled House passed a $3 trillion package 10 weeks ago, but the Republican controlled Senate has spent its time approving new federal judges. As a result of infighting within the party and between Republican members of the Senate and the president, they have been unable to cobble together even a basic counterproposal. Their initial stab at a $1 trillion plan included a reduced benefit of $200, while including over $1 billion to build a new FBI headquarters and money to replace defense dollars that Trump reallocated to build the southern border wall. When that failed to gain traction, they offered a one-week extension of the current $600 payment, which Democrats viewed as a short-term fix that would allow the Senate to head out of town for their summer break. Economists have pointed out that the elimination of the $600 benefit will ripple through the economy, causing an even greater downturn. Housing and health experts worry about millions being forced into the street in the coming months as the coronavirus continues to grow unchecked. Leaders of both parties rejected President Trump's suggestion to delay the November general election, and former President Barack Obama has called for major voting rights reforms. With those stories and more, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Once we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we should keep marching to make it even better by making sure every American is automatically registered to vote, including former inmates who've earned their second chance.
But that's not all former President Barack Obama said at the funeral for the late Georgia representative and civil rights icon John Lewis yesterday in Atlanta, Georgia. Obama called for a variety of reforms, more polling places and early voting, a national holiday on Election Day, equal representation for citizens in Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., an end to partisan gerrymandering, and even eliminating the filibuster if that's what it takes. But he also said more citizens need to believe their votes will make a difference.
So we're also going to have to remember what John said. If you don't do everything you can do to change things, then they will remain the same.
Top Republicans yesterday rejected Trump's suggestion that he might delay the election. GOP Senators Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, among others, assured reporters the election will go on as planned November 3rd. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine noted that Trump can't delay the election. It's written in the Constitution that only Congress has that authority.
We hold elections, we accept the results, even if we don't like the results, whatever it is. And we accept those results, and that's one of the things that makes our country great.
Washington Secretary of State Bob Ferguson says he's ready to sue if necessary. In New York, which had its primary over a month ago, the Board of Elections just finished counting absentee ballots this week. In the 12th District, which covers Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, the rejection rate was 20%. The most common reason was a missing postmark.
That already is such a red flag across the board because, you know, states that you would think of as more voter suppressive, states like Georgia or all of the issues in Wisconsin, all of those states have invalidation rates of less than 1% when it comes to vote by mail.
Cassie Moreno is the communications director for Suraj Patel, who ran in the 12th District House Democratic primary but lost to incumbent Representative Carolyn Maloney. A federal court heard arguments yesterday in a lawsuit filed by the Patel campaign to get some of those ballots reinstated. Ballots were sent in prepaid postage business envelopes, which aren't usually postmarked. The Postal Service agreed to make an exception for the election, but that appears to have been carried out to varying degrees. While the campaign accepts the loss, Moreno says they want to ensure that all voters are heard now and in November.
People like President Trump and the GOP, the Republicans, have started to point to our race here in New York's 12th District as a reason to distrust mail-in voting. And we want to get out the perspective that that should absolutely not be the case.
And Herman Cain, a co-chair of Black Voices for Trump, died from the new coronavirus yesterday in Atlanta. The 2012 candidate for the Republican nomination and former CEO tested positive 9 days after attending Trump's indoor rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Senate oversight hearing learned that the Bureau of Indian Education does not have the resources it needs to safely reopen schools. With that story and more, we go to Art Hughes with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Schools operating under the Bureau of Indian Education are not given the resources or guidance to safely reopen this fall under the continuing threat of the coronavirus. That's the message sent during an oversight hearing in the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. Among those testifying at the hearing was Marita Hines, president of the National Indian Education Association. She also works at the BIE Tribal Grant School at Tusuque Pueblo in New Mexico. She says the federal coronavirus relief aid so far allocated to her school barely covers purchase of personal protection equipment for staff and students, but not enough for the materials needed if the school converts to online-only instruction.
We are buying all the PPE products, but also our staff, they need the resources to have the programs to go online. We purchased a math and reading program, but that was it. We're going to need a lot more programs for distance learning.
David Yarlett also testified. He's chair of the American Indian Higher Education Consortium and president of Little Bighorn College in Montana. He said his faculty faced a steep learning curve when forced to switch to online-only instruction at the beginning of the pandemic, but he says students often fared worse.
Many of the students didn't have access to internet, Wi-Fi. They tried to get to where they could connect. And then many students just had their cell phones, which was vastly inadequate as far as trying to do homework. All they could do was communicate back and forth. In certain situations, they just dropped off, completely.
Yarlett says his college needs additional resources to respond adequately in the coming months. New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Udall faulted the Bureau of Indian Affairs for failing to offer clear guidance for BIE schools that serve some 41,000 students. He challenged the department over delays in getting some $220 million in coronavirus relief funds to schools, which he said exacerbates ongoing discrepancies in funding for educating Native students. Tribes in Massachusetts are applauding a vote in the state Senate this week to review the state's flag that includes an image of a Native American man. The Senate voted unanimously to create a commission to review the symbols that many tribes have criticized as offensive. The flag includes a composite image of a man based on an Ojibwe chief. The tribe is not from Massachusetts. It also includes an arm holding a sword over the man's head. The motto is a Latin phrase that translates to, "By the sword, we seek peace." In a press release, Senate President Karen Spilka said the legislation is an opportunity to begin a conversation about the state's history and reimagine what a truly inclusive state seal and motto can look like. The state House of Representatives and governor must also approve the measure before the commission is formed. In Maine, the legislature's Judiciary Committee is trying to finalize language this week on a bill to return control of tribal land to four of the state's tribes. News Center Maine reports the committee and task force have been working for more than a year on drafting legislation, but progress was halted at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. At issue is the 40-year-old Maine Indian Land Claims Act signed by President Jimmy Carter. It allowed Maine tribes to purchase land but restricted the tribes' governance of that land. Penobscot Nation Chief Kirk Francis tells New Center Maine the lack of sovereignty over their own land stands in the way of everything from expanding tribal land to economic development for the tribe. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
Pollution from unrecycled plastic has increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. For more, we go to Nadia Ramlagan of the Public News Service.
As millions of people pledge to go plastic-free this month as part of the Sierra Club's Plastic Free July campaign, plastic usage in the U.S. has increased amid the coronavirus pandemic. Randy Poklodnik is a retired research chemist and environmental activist in southeastern Ohio. She says plastic packaging tossed into the garbage ends up in a landfill, where it begins to leach toxic chemicals that, over time, seep into the soil and water.
They just don't break down. I mean, they're experimenting with some bacteria and enzymes to help cleave the linkages between the polymers, but basically they don't break down, and they found yogurt containers on the beaches with 1970 dates on them.
Some local governments in Ohio, such as the city of Bexley, have adopted ordinances to curb the distribution of plastic bags and other single-use items. However, state lawmakers recently advanced legislation aimed at prohibiting municipalities from passing so-called plastic bag bans. While plastic recycling efforts have been hampered by the coronavirus, Poklodnik points out most plastics are not designed to be reusable or recyclable.
40% plus of most of the plastics made today are single-use packaging, and I don't think it would take long for somebody to realize that to step into any grocery store, and you'll see aisles and aisles of beverages in plastic bottles.
She says exposure to plastic pollution has been shown to have a host of negative health effects, including cancers, birth defects, and immune system problems.
Some of the compounds that are used in heavy metals that are used in the plastic formulations are very toxic. They get into the human body. It's very disturbing.
A study from the Rochester Institute of Technology estimates that 5.5 million pounds of plastic trash, including lids, food wrappers, straws, stirrers, bottles, and plastic bags are dumped into Lake Erie each year. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Farmers have begun leasing their land for solar energy developers as a way to supplement their income. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Solar developers need land where they can install solar panels, and many farmers are looking for new ways to make money from their land, especially as they approach the end of their careers. Charles Gould is an energy educator with Michigan State University Extension. In his state, about a third of farmers are 65 or older.
And they want to retire. They've worked hard all their lives, and the profit margins for agriculture have been so thin.
He says fewer young people are taking over their family farms, so older farmers often consider selling their land to housing or commercial developers. But leasing acreage for solar installations has become an alternative source of annual income.
When farmers are approached with a lease agreement that can pay, depending on how close you are to the power substation, $1,200 to, you know, $500 an acre, that's very attractive.
What's more, Michigan farmers can earn tax breaks for keeping land preserved as open space. That can include land leased for solar, as long as it meets certain conservation standards. So Gould says growing solar can be a way for farmers to continue making money from their land while preserving it for future generations. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 31st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Art Hughes, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. corporate media were in vocal support of last year's coup against Bolivia's Evo Morales. But they're rather quiet now that Jeanine Añez, who, in a legislative session without a quorum, due to the fact that many lawmakers were in hiding, jumped the line of succession and declared herself president, is now putting off holding elections again, and has said she is running, despite previous promises to the contrary. U.S. media were frictionless transmitters for assertions of fraud in Morales' re-election coming from the Organization of American States, assertions that some now quietly